Hi. So welcome everyone to our little session on exploring Krishna's culture. First of all, thank you very much for allowing me to visit you and to spend a couple of days in your wonderful association. Since this is my first time I'm visiting this part of the world, maybe I will introduce myself a little bit, because usually people are wondering who is this person there, you know? So first of all, my name is Devaki Devi Dasi. I am actually originally from Germany, but I left Germany already in 1984, actually. So that's more than 30 years now. I was working in Germany as a physiotherapist in a private practice. I was making good money, had everything materially. But nevertheless, I realized with my treatments, I cannot give people real happiness. I could see that. So and then one day, well, gradually I became more and more dissatisfied with my work. So one day I decided, let me give up my work. And I sold everything, gave everything away, packed a backpack, and started traveling the world, searching for the medicine which would give real happiness. And I traveled quite a bit around Europe, around Africa, around Australia. And then finally in Australia, I met the devotees in Sydney. And they gave me Bhagavad Gita as it is and Science of Self-Realization. And as soon as I started reading, within 3-4 days, I realized this is it. I had found what I was looking for. I had a long journey of so many adventures checking out in Australia over the different hippie communes and philosophical spiritual groups there, but nothing really, you know, satisfied me. But then when I met the devotees on a farm outside Sydney, actually, I came to the farm. I didn't even know anything about Krishna consciousness. But then within 4 or 5 days, I realized that's it. So, and then very quickly, I immediately chanted 16 rounds, followed the principles. It was really such a relief, you know, just like, oh, finally coming home. So since then, I never left the Association of Devotees. That was beginning of 85, so it's exactly 30 years ago. And I was 4 years in the Madhuji's ashram, getting all the basic training of all the different aspects of devotional life. I accepted initiation of Bhavananda Maharaj at the time, now Prabhu. And then in 89, I decided to enter the Grihastha Ashram. So I was married for 4 years, for 10 years. So I didn't always look like this. I was having earrings and nose ring and silk saris and hair and all the rest of it. So I went through that phase. So and in these 10 years, by Krishna's arrangement, we kind of established the first more organized temple in the former Soviet Union in Latvia, Baltics. My former husband's parents came from there, and he knew the language. So that's how I came back to Europe. And we were busy with that for about 10 years, from 89 to 99. It was a very amazing adventure. We started with absolutely nothing, no deities, no saris, no spices. It was just the end of the communist times, you know, 89. And in the first visit, still the KGB was chasing us and was quite adventurous. We had to have the programs in the forest so they couldn't find us, you know. And we were part of the first Vatyatras in Moscow, Petersburg, this, that, you know, was an amazing transcendental adventure in pioneer work there. So and then 99, my former husband decided to take a break from Krishna consciousness. These things do happen. So he went back to Australia, remarried a non-devotee. Even today, he's not really following anything. He's maybe still barely vegetarian, but that's about all. So anyway, even though these things are a little sad, at the same time, I thought, all right, let me take this as Krishna's mercy and move on in my life to the more renounced phase of life. I was 40 at the time, so it was relatively early, but nevertheless, for me, it was actually very natural, I have to admit. So, and since then, that was 1990. So, no, hang on, 99. Right, yes, 99. So since 1999, that's 16 years now, I'm living the life of a traveling preacher. I took reinitiation a couple more times. Prabhu Vishnu Prabhu, now a former Swami, I took initiation of him. And then one more time of His Holiness Niranjana Swami. So in Kali Yuga, we have to do everything three times, you know. But nevertheless, all these personalities, they were actually the perfect guru at that time. Really, perfect. Yes, my life would have gone completely differently if I had not taken shelter of these personalities. So that's actually guru tattva, that Krishna sends the right person at the right time to bring us further. And for some people, that's several personalities, either in one life or over several lifetimes. Yes, same. So there's no loss, there's no hard feelings or anything. It was actually perfectly Krishna's arrangement, what can I say? Yes, so and for the last 16 years, my life is basically, I spent 6 months in India and Bangladesh and a little bit also Nepal and 6 months in Europe. And when I'm in Europe, I'm mainly in Ukraine. But also now I'm starting to go a little bit to Germany also. And I've been visiting Sweden and Moldova and the Baltics sometimes and Hungary and Radadesh and, you know, a few little places around there, you know, like that. And my main two, you know, my main two topics in my humble preaching attempts is first of all the holy name. I'm very much convinced that we have not been making really enough effort to get on deeper levels of chanting in japa as well as in kirtan. We often take this chanting very lightly, just walking around, blabbering something, nishnishramam, nishnishramam, and sightseeing, shopping, this, that. But there's so much more to chanting than that, you know. Yes. So in all those places where I'm visiting, we usually conduct holy name retreats, even in Ekachakra, Nityananda's birthplace. I'm always taking a whole busload full of people out there and engage them for 3-4 days, and it's always quite a transformational experience. Also in other countries, in Germany, in Ukraine, Moldova, Sweden, we conduct holy name retreats. So that's number one. And topic number two is spiritual culture. Yes. Because Bangladesh is a very unique place. It's East Bengal. And it's actually the place where most of Mahaprabhu's associates come from. Rupa Goswami, Sanatana Goswami. Oh, who else? Mukunda Datta, Vasudev Datta, Pundarik Vidyanidhi. Yesterday, Marge was telling the story with Pundarik Vidyanidhi. So that happened. We have a place there, Pundarik Dam. Very beautiful place. That happened in East Bengal, which is today Bangladesh. And also Advaita Chaya, Jagannath Mishra, Sachimata, they all come from East Bengal, you know. So, and because today it is a Muslim country, this is a real blessing in disguise, because that preserves the Vaishnav culture. Because as we know, Muslims are not so fond of all this so-called Western nonsense. They're very traditional, very traditional. And that's what really has kept the Vaishnav culture there. So Bangladesh is like a different planet. When I travel there, I always feel like I'm entering Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's very amazing. All the Bhajan Kirtan Prasadam culture, it's all still going on very amazingly. Yes. So, and over the last 15, 16 years, because I've spent so much time there, and when I'm there, I'm only with the locals. There's no Western devotees living there. You see? So you get a completely different experience than when we go to Mayapur Vrindavan, because there we are usually, you know, with our friends from the same yatra, same country, whatever. We don't associate actually with the locals much, you know. But Bangladesh, I'm only with the locals. I travel with them. I preach with them. I eat with them. I live with them. You know, I go on Prabhupada marathon with them, everything. So, and that gave me quite a few insights into spiritual culture. I've learned so much from them, and I'm still learning every time I'm going there. So, and that gave me quite a few realizations, how important the spiritual culture is, how it is actually Krishna's system to support our spiritual practice. Yes. So, and I am very firmly convinced not only that we have to make some effort to get on deeper levels of chanting, but also that we have to get to deeper understanding of culture. Yes. I am so bold to say, unless we get some deeper understanding and we manage to bring more and more aspects of spiritual culture in our life, yeah, it will not be so easy to make Lord Chaitanya Sankirtan movement very strong and solid. I'm pretty convinced of this, actually, you know, over the years. Yes. Yes, so in any case, this is just a little bit of background, you know, where I'm coming from type thing. So now I am traveling to quite a few places. I have put together different courses, all on spiritual culture. I'm teaching them every year also in Mayapur. I spend 2.5 months every year in Mayapur, and I give seminars and courses there and holy name retreat and so on. But also in other places in Ukraine and Golokadam, Radha Desh, here, there, you know, I'm giving these courses. Women in spiritual culture, marriage in spiritual culture, the elderly in spiritual culture, because the Vanaprastha Ashram is practically not established in ISKCON. It's a cultural thing, you know. Yes. The children in spiritual culture. Yeah, it's quite a deep topic. So today, I simply want to give some little introduction in this topic of culture. You know, it's a big topic, and all we can do in 1.5 hours just to give some little insights so that we have some understanding what is culture all about. You know, where does it come from? How does it develop? So we have a few handouts here. Maybe we can quickly distribute them just so you can take something home and ponder over it. And maybe you even have a pen and paper and you can take a few notes. Then you will get more out of this discussion. Most of you understand English, right? Yes, that's good. Okay, so everybody's got their materials in front of them. it also helps to be attentive, you know, when you look at the materials, because they're basically key points. And sometimes there's some dotted lines where you can put some little things in there. And we will do it a little bit interactive. I will ask you, we will collect different things together. Right? So now, to begin with, let us understand, what is culture? Where does it come from? What is it affecting? Right? So to some extent, we can say every country has its culture, right? There's South Indian culture, there's German culture, there's Italian culture with pizza and spaghetti, and there's Russian culture, Ukrainian culture, this, that. But ultimately, we can say there's actually only two kinds of cultures in this world. And that is what? If you want to say something, please lift your hand. We will do this like in school here. Don't just shout out. Yes, two kinds of culture. Very true. Material and spiritual. I'm glad you didn't say Eastern and Western, because this is getting very, very mixed up these days, you know. Even India is becoming very materialistic, actually, and the spiritual culture is getting more and more lost. Very true. So there's basically two kinds of cultures, materialistic and spiritual culture. So now, without looking too much on your papers, because there you might find the answer, let me ask you, how is culture coming about? What is it based on? Any idea? Tradition, yeah, very important part of culture. What else? What is really the foundation of culture? Certain values, very good. What else? A bit more than that. Huh? Goal of life, yes. Somebody was saying something. Please lift your hand. Don't just shout out. The way of life. Yes. Well, the values and the goal of life. Family. Big part of culture. Basically, culture has a certain underlying worldview, a philosophy, an ideology, right? This includes values, goal of life. It means there is a certain worldview, a certain philosophy there, and by living, by practically applying that worldview, culture develops, right? In all different aspects of life, we get the culture by living a certain worldview, ideology, philosophy. Huh? Yes. So, and not only comes the culture about through the philosophy, but it also reinforces that worldview. It propagates that worldview, right? So the effect goes both ways. You know, from consciousness comes the culture, but then also the culture feeds back the consciousness and reinforces it and propagates it, right? Yes? Yeah. So, and Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, actually Maharaj this morning was even quoting the verse, my favorite verse, which is really summing up very nicely these two different cultures. That's 269. Right? What is night for all beings is the time of awakening for the self-controlled. And the time of awakening for all beings is night for the introspective sage. Yes. So what's Krishna saying here? He's basically saying there's two types of people, and what is night for one is awakening for the other, and vice versa. Right? What is night for all beings means who? Who is all beings? Huh? Who is the all beings? You tell me. Come on. Don't sit here and sleep. You have to think along. Who are the all beings? What is night for all beings? Who are they? Huh? Yes? Yes, yeah, so basically the materialists. Yes. So what is night for all beings, meaning the materialist, is time of awakening for the self-controlled. Who is the self-controlled? Spiritualist, yes. And then, and the time of awakening for all beings, again the materialist, what is day for the materialist, is night for the introspective sage, right? For the spiritualist. So, what is day for the materialist is night for the spiritualist. What is day for the spiritualist is night for the materialist. So these two cultures are actually like day and night. Yes. Because they propagate completely opposite worldviews. Completely. We can imagine it like a very broad spectrum. On one day, on one hand is the day of the materialist. On the other end is the day of the spiritualist. Right? So, and this is what Krishna consciousness is actually meant to bring about. That the day of the materialist, gradually, through our spiritual practice, is transformed into the day of the spiritualist, which is like night for the materialist. Right? You understand what I'm saying? Yes? Or not? Yes. See, Krishna consciousness is a very deep transformational process. It is meant to transform our likes and dislikes, our tastes, our attachments, our worldviews, everything. It is meant to transform. If this is not happening, then our spiritual practice is rather external, you know? If we only externally, we put on tilak, sari, dhoti, walk around with dhaba beads, but internally we hang on to all the old ways of doing things, the old tastes, the old likes and dislikes from our materialistic life. If we hang on to that internally, well, then our spiritual practice is pretty superficial, isn't it? It is meant to transform ultimately the heart so that pure bhakti can develop there. But as long as so many tastes and likes and dislikes of materialistic ways of living are still there in the heart and the consciousness, there is no room for bhakti to grow. The soil is not prepared. It has to be transformed. And that exactly is what Krishna consciousness is meant to bring about. Yes. And the culture, very, very helpful in this process of transformation. Yes. Yes. Yeah, so it's a very broad spectrum. On one hand, the day of the materialist, one end, the day of the spiritualist, and we have to gradually, at our own pace, voluntarily, do this internal work of transformation. You see? It cannot be imposed. It cannot be forced. But it took me many, many years. So many years. I mean, I have only received some little transformation there because I spend every year so much time in the middle of spiritual culture. being surrounded by spiritual culture. That's what helped me to make that transformation, you see. But unless that transformation happens, then our spiritual life is very external and superficial, actually, you know. Krishna consciousness is all about transformation. We don't want to keep things as they are, but we want to move forward. And it's never ending. There's never an end to it. We can always move further and further. Yes. Yes. So now, instead of, you know, day and night, what else can we set there? What other terms? What's day and night standing for? What to do, what not to do. So how do we call this? Okay, what else? Huh? What's this day and night standing for? Huh? Light and darkness, yes. And what's light and darkness stand for? Knowledge and ignorance, yes. And what else? There's a similar pair of terms. Knowledge and ignorance and reality and illusion, yes, exactly. So I'm sure we all have that experience from preaching, you know, that very often in the street when we give out books, people say, oh, you guys, you Hare Krishnas, you are an illusion. You're escaping reality. You're mad, right? And we say the same thing to them. Or maybe we think it. We might not say it. But we think, no, you guys are an illusion. You're mad. You think you are the body, right? You think this temporary situation, this is actual reality, but it's not. You don't know that you have an eternal relationship with Krishna. You guys are mad. You see? So that's how a materialist and a spiritualist, they live in completely different realities, actually. Very different reality. You see? And these two realities are like day and night. I even remember I spent some time in Sydney in the temple in the city, and that temple was in the middle of the nightlife district, King's Cross it's called. So it was surrounded by the most degrading activities, or, you know, bars and nightclubs and prostitutes and this and that. And in the middle, the temple was there, you know, best place for preaching. And it was literally like this. When our day began at 4:30, we were going to Mangalarti, the materialist day was ending. They were all going home, all drunk, intoxicated, you know, after the whole night of trying to enjoy the senses. Their day ended when our day began. And same thing in the evening when we took rest, you know, devotees like to take rest early, 8:30, 9 o'clock. We were going home to take rest. They were just crawling out of their holds, recovering, and their day began. Yes, they were going out another night of enjoyment there. So it even was literally like this, you know, when our day began, their day was ending. Yeah, so these two cultures and realities are really like day and night because they're based on completely opposite worldviews and goals of life and values, you know. So let us discuss, let us collect now the underlying worldview of materialistic culture, just to be clear. I'm sure we all know it, but just to write them all down and be really clear in this, what is the worldview, the mottos of materialistic culture? You tell me. Yes? Yes, that's a really important one. You only live once. therefore, no idea of purifying duties. Right? If you only live once, if that's it, then why should you worry about the future? Why, you know, there's no concept of, oh, there's some reaction, some karma or something. Existence continues after this lifetime. You actually are meant to, you know, rectify yourself and purify yourself and go back home, back to Godhead. No understanding of all that. So it's just you live once. That's it. So naturally, what do we do if we only live once? Enjoy it to the max. Yes. The more the better. Whatever feels good, do it. Enjoy now. As long as you can. You know? So there's no idea of purifying duties. Yeah, that's a really big difference between spiritual culture, materialistic culture, you know? That in spiritual culture, Bhagavad Gita is all about doing one's duty and remembering Krishna and becoming thus qualified and purified to go back home, back to Godhead. You know, that's actually what Krishna consciousness is all about, that we do our duty. We are meant to play a certain role here in life. And by doing that and remembering Krishna, chanting the holy name, that will purify us. So materialistic culture, no idea of this. So goal of life is? Yes, sense gratification. And which sense gratification is the topmost? Sex life, yeah, that's what keeps the whole thing going on and on and on here in the world, right? And it is heavily being propagated. Oh, we are not even conscious so much of it. How much we are actually simply a product of our surroundings, you know? That whole programming, that whole propaganda is so strong. It's so deep rooted there in the consciousness and the heart. We don't even realize. We think we are making our own decisions here or something, but no, we are taking it all in, you know, because it's very subtle also, you know, and we don't even realize. And we carry that same conditioning with us. Lifetime after lifetime, it's all stored in the subtle body of mind, intelligence, thoughts, ego. That accompanies us lifetime after lifetime. So we've got a few things that are very deeply rooted, you know, in the subtle body. And that follows us, you know, some luggage we are carrying around here with us. Yes. So that's the thing. Sense gratification is the goal of life. Sex life, topmost enjoyment. What else? What else is the basic motto of materialistic culture? Few more really basic things. Wealth. Yeah, without wealth you can't enjoy much the senses. You need some money in the pocket, right? Yes. Exploiting others. As soon as there's sense gratification there, then there's exploitation, envy, competition. That's all coming along with sense gratification. Yeah. Yeah, that's the subtle sense gratification, being the supreme controller, enjoyer, proprietor, right? Materialist sees himself as the center of the universe, and he sees everything around him, you know, in connection with himself. How is this useful for me and my sense gratification? How can I use this for me? That's the vision of a materialist. And he tries to be the supreme controller, enjoyer, proprietor. Yes. And what else? Fear of death. Yeah. Has to come along with what? With what does the fear of death come along? What's the basic concept of material life? I'm this body. Yes. Yes. No understanding of the soul. It's all focused on bodily needs, bodily identification. That's an interesting thing, that materialistic culture, you know, increases the bodily concept on the gross level, you know, that we identify with the body in the gross terms, but also subtle body, especially intelligence and false ego. In materialistic culture, they are blown up and increased to the maximum. I am so special and unique and extraordinary, and I'm the center, and everybody has to recognize me. Right? And I am so different. That's a big thing in materialistic culture, trying to be different than everybody else. Unique. You know? That's all the influence of false ego. And intelligence. You know, so much emphasis is put on degrees, titles, positions. You know, I'm so intelligent. I am, you know, PhD and this and that and this and that. So we are proud of our intelligence and we think we are so special and fantastic. And materialistic culture is all around blowing that up, blowing up the subtle body and increasing it to the max. Yeah. What else? Let me see. Do we have anything else here? Well, and, you know, of course, I am God. There is no God. God is dead. You know? I'm the supreme. Yes. So that's the basic, these are the basic mottos of materialistic culture. So now let's collect the mottos of spiritual culture. All we have to do is take the opposite. So, quickly help. You tell. Huh? Our goal is Krishna, exactly. Goal of life is to reestablish this loving relationship with Krishna. That's the goal of life. So, what do we do with sense gratification? Yes. So we use our senses in Krishna's service, wanting to satisfy his senses. So we basically minimize sense gratification. And we keep it in that frame of Krishna consciousness. Right? Krishna consciousness gives us a certain frame where we can satisfy our senses. Tongue wants to eat nice foodstuffs, okay, eat Krishna prasad, you know. The ears want to hear some nice music, okay, hear bhajan kirtan. Eyes want to see something beautiful, okay, take darshan of the deities. Also, there's some desire for sex life, okay, have children in Krishna consciousness. So there is, Krishna is giving us a certain frame here, in which we can satisfy our senses and use them in Krishna service and purify them. But as a long-term thing, basically we reduce sense gratification with a goal to actually give up the taste. Right? Yes, we want to replace sense gratification with a higher pleasure, with something better, something more joyful. That's the ultimate goal. So in spiritual life, we are minimizing sense gratification and sex life. The whole spiritual culture is meant to do that, to minimize this whole fever of lusty desires. That's what spiritual culture is meant for. You know, and materialistic culture is feeding the fever of lust. Very opposite. Completely opposite. So what else? What else are the mottos of spiritual culture? There's still a few missing. Yes? I'm not the body. Body is just a temporary vehicle. I'm eternal soul. Right? Yes. So again, spiritual culture minimizes bodily concept, gross and subtle. It is so designed that we get off the bodily platform, how we say, you know, we lose that focus on I am this body, and it helps to understand, actually, I'm not this body. Yeah. And also on the subtle platform too, it helps actually to decrease and dissolve the subtle body, especially intelligence and false ego, especially. Materialistic culture is increasing and blowing it up and, you know, feeding it. And spiritual culture is reducing it and helping us to give it up. Because as long as we have a subtle body, we cannot go back to Godhead. Yes, we have to completely transform the subtle body. We have to dissolve the false ego. We have to completely transform the mind and the intelligence and fully spiritualize it. Otherwise, subtle body will take the soul to the next gross body. And that is not so easy. In the Sunday feast class, we will talk a little bit about this topic of death. Yeah, because it's good to know what actually happens there and how to prepare. And I tell you frankly, the longer I'm in Krishna consciousness, the more I realize not so easy to go back to Godhead. Yes, it really requires a deep internal work. Yes, as Krishna consciousness requires so much introspection and deep internal work. Yes. Very easily we can completely miss the target. You know? In the name of Krishna consciousness, we can just feed and blow up the false ego and try to become a big important person here. Facebook, everybody has to know what I'm doing and here I am and this and that. Oh my God, you know? Yes, yes, yes. I always call it ego book. I don't do anything on Facebook. I've had a look at it once when it came out and I knew this is not for me. Thank you very much. But of course I know many of our gurus, they're also, you know, doing things on Facebook. But they're just doing it because they know the world is so addicted to Facebook, you know. Yes. But very easily you can really just, oh, you know, try and become famous. Everybody has to see what I'm doing. And here is the picture of me leading the kirtan here and there. And, oh. Yeah, so very easily, in the name of spiritual life, we can do completely the opposite. We can just feed and blow up the false ego, you know, and the subtle body instead of dissolving it and reducing it and giving it up. Yes, yes, so, wow. Yes. So what else do we have? Spiritual culture. What more mottos? Yeah, we said, I'm not this body, not gross, not subtle. So spiritual culture dissolves the subtle body and helps us to give up the gross bodily concept. What else? Yes? To serve others, yes, yes. So instead of exploiting others for our sense gratification, there's spiritual culture is that mood of service. Right? Yes, very true. And what else? Yes, that's also there. But let's just stick to the mottos, to the principles, the underlying worldviews. No details, please. Krishna is the supreme controller, proprietor, enjoyer, you know, and I'm just a tiny, tiny, insignificant little servant here. Servant of the servant of the servant. So materialistic culture is all about becoming a big and important person, and spiritual culture is all about realizing our tiny, insignificant position of being servant of the servant of the servant. So it's really opposite, you know, really opposite. Yes, and we said already, because the soul is eternal, there's existence after this life, so therefore purifying duties, right? That's an important part of spiritual culture. Yeah, I think we basically have got the main points here. So, I mean, already now, when we look at these two ideologies and philosophies, we can very clearly understand, wow, you know, they're really 180 degrees opposite. Right? They actually are incompatible. You can't make them match. No, it doesn't matter how much you try, you know, because materialistic culture promotes and reinforces that kind of consciousness which we want to give up, that kind of worldview, you know. So as long as we are hanging on to, you know, ways of materialistic life and its culture, we are always pulled away from those worldviews which we want to develop. Very clear, isn't it? Yes? I don't see any heads nodding here. Do you understand what I'm saying? Are you with me? Yes? Yes? Well, then why not let me know here, you know? I want you to understand what I'm talking here about. I don't want to just talk in the emptiness here. Yeah, so 180 degrees opposite, different direction. So that's why Krishna is saying they are like day and night. Right? But as we were saying, it's a gradual transformation, which everybody has to do within their own hearts. It cannot be imposed. This is sometimes the mistake we are doing, that we are confronting, you know, the day of the materialist with the day of the spiritualist. And then often, especially when the ego is involved, you know, then some ego clashes there, you know. So let's understand, you know, these cultures are so different. They're promoting the opposite philosophy. And we gradually, you know, in between the day of the materialist, day of the spiritualist, there's so many different shades and grades of mixtures there. You see? But we have to have that goal in mind, that if we want to become true spiritualists, then material life and its culture has to become our night. Has to. If we want to become true spiritualists. And it might take a while to get there, you know. But that should be our goal, you know. If we want to become true spiritualists. Yes, then sooner or later, that materialistic culture has to become night for us. We have to turn our back towards materialistic culture. And we have to transform our likings, our ties, in such a way that we like, you know, all the different aspects of spiritual culture. That's what it means to become a true materialist, you know, a true spiritualist. Okay. Maybe before we go on, let me see if just about this, what we discussed here now, if we have any comments or questions about this. Okay. Yes, it's a bit early now to get into that question. See, I'm one of those people who strongly believe that we have to be very clear in the principles, underlying principles. And when we deeply understand the underlying principles, then actually the application follows. Then we know how to apply according to time, place, and circumstance. But if we don't understand the principles, then we will be forever confused over the details. Yes. So let us first understand how these cultures are like day and night. You know, let us be clear on that, because often we are not clear and we think, well, why not take all these elements from materialistic culture into Krishna consciousness? You know, so that people accept Krishna consciousness more or something, you know? Because see, interesting to understand that in all spiritual cultures, not only Krishna consciousness, you will actually find the same underlying principles. And you will see that in other spiritual cultures, the leaders were not understanding the universal principles. And therefore, they were getting lost in the name of reformation, in the name of modernizing. They lost the principles. You see? And that's kind of my fear and worry a little bit, you know, in these 30 years where I've been in ISKCON. Well, I'm sorry to say, but I can see that we're a little bit heading this way sometimes, that the principles of spiritual culture are getting lost in the name of reformation, in the name of modernizing, and then it becomes watered down. And that really happened in Christianity. You know, when I was a child, I grew up in Germany in a small village there. My God, you know, 50 years ago, life in Germany was completely different than now. You know, yes. Yes, even different principles, you know, centered around religious life in the church. It's all gone. It's all, I remember when I had this, you know, I was Protestant, when I had this confirmation in church, right? This confirmation, you know, you have this? Something, you know? I remember we had to wear black and white, you know, some black skirt, white blouse. And I said to my mother, I want to wear an elegant trousers. I don't want to wear a skirt. You know, because I was singing in a church choir. And on concerts, we also had to wear black and white. And I had this very wide, elegant, not jeans or something, but very elegant concert trousers. And I wanted to wear them at the confirmation. And then my mother said, you know, a woman should not wear trousers in the skirt, trousers in the church. And I said, oh, really? Why is that? Well, she couldn't give me an answer, you know. She said, well, that's the way it is. A woman should not wear trousers in the church, you know. So, you know, 40 years ago, that understanding was still there amongst some people. But now, my God, people now go in shorts and miniskirts to the church, you know. It's all lost on jeans or whatever feels good, you know. So that's, as an example, that's what happens, you know, if the leaders of a spiritual, you know, of a spiritual path and its culture and organization, if they don't understand the underlying principles, then very easily we lose them. And I feel we have to be very careful in this, that this doesn't happen in Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, you know, Lord Chaitanya Sankirtan movement, will not be very strong and solid, you know. Yes, yes. Yeah, so that's why, for the time being, I don't really want to go, especially in this discussion, we don't have much time. But it's a valid question, of course, you know. But let's first be clear in the principles of things. Yeah. You want to ask something? Yeah. Yeah, of course, because Sambandha just, you know, gives the basic understanding, the spiritual knowledge of who am I, you know, what is this world about, who is Krishna, what's my relationship? So Sambandha is the basic thing, you know, to live spiritual life, you know. So, and that is very different to materialistic knowledge, you know. So already there is that day and night aspect there, you know, that a materialist, for him, Sambandha Gyan is ignorance. It's not gyan, but ignorance. You know? Right? So that's the foundation, sambandha gyan, you know? And on that, everything else develops, you know? Yes. Okay, let us continue for the time being. So let us quickly collect some practical aspects of our daily life which are forming culture. Very, very basic practical aspects of our daily life. Just to become a little more conscious of how actually culture affects us and appears in our daily life. What comes to your mind? Basic aspects of daily life, you know, which are forming culture. Huh? Yes, music. Very true. Music, definitely. What else? Even more daily and food, yes, there's a certain food culture there, what we eat. Relationships between people, between different sections of society, yes. What else? Very true. I was waiting for that one. That's really the very first and almost foremost one. The way we dress, fashion, yes, yes. And another thing that's closely connected with fashion, hairstyle, yes, hairstyle. And, of course, there's so many more, you know, recreation, what do people do in their free time, and education, you know, and even approach to medical treatments, very different in the two cultures, you know, materialistic worldview and spiritual worldview. So many. But I would just like to take three and play them through, just so you understand the whole drift of this discussion. I would like to concentrate on fashion, hairstyle, music. Just to look at them because they're really part of our daily life, you know. And it also now with this discussion, it helps us to assess ourselves. Where am I here on this spectrum of spiritual culture, materialistic culture? You know? So, let us have a look at fashion. Fashion in materialistic culture, we can divide in ignorance, passion, and goodness. Right? You know, materialistic life, everything is under the three modes of nature. So what do you think? What is fashion in the mode of ignorance? What does that look like? Huh? Ugly. Well, that's very subjective. What is ugly for you is maybe beautiful for somebody else. But what is ignorance always? Dirty, yes. Yes, so it's dirty and also neglected, broken, ripped, withheld, you know? Like, for example, these pants with the slits in it, you know? They look old and ripped, but they're brand new. You buy them like this. So this is actually fashion in the mode of ignorance, right? Or these pants that, you know, don't fit. They hang down to the knees there, and when you bend over, your backside shows and all that. So this is all fashion in the mode of ignorance, you know? Doesn't fit. I mean, really, the fashion industry, they're running out of ideas, you know? That's why the fashion is getting more and more crazy, more and more, you know, influenced by the mode of ignorance. Because everything has been already, and people have to come up with more and more crazy things just to get everybody to buy the latest thing. So the whole consuming thing is going on. So that's why things becoming more and more in the mode of ignorance. Yes, Sam. Yes. So that's basically fashion in the mode of ignorance. Dirty, ripped, broken. Also black, everything black. like that, you know. So now, fashion in the mode of passion. It's even rhyming. What's that? Fashion in the mode of passion. Huh? Well, that's there everywhere. I am different, you know. That's the whole thing in materialistic culture. That's in goodness, passion, ignorance. Sometimes people, you know, look for so crazy ideas just to be different than everybody else, you know. No, but what's the real strong characteristic of fashion and the mode of passion? Come on, think of the goal of life. Yes, yes, yes. The whole thing of exposing the body, attracting the opposite gender, feeding the fever of lust, that whole thing, you know, the more the better, you know. I always make this joke, the less cloth is used for a woman's dress, the more expensive. You know, it should be the other way around, you think, you know, the more cloth is used, but no, it's the less cloth is used. Yeah, see through, exposing, feeding the fever of lust. Yes. And I mean, in the women's fashion, it's very strong there, but the same is also there in the men's fashion, you know, to be all cool and attractive and, you know, the name brands and, you know, oh, I wear such and such. I don't know these brands, you know, I'm too out of touch with things, you know, but anyway. So it's there in the men too, in the men's fashion, just a little bit more subtle maybe, you know. So now what's fashion in the mode of goodness? What's that? What does that look like? Hmm? What? Hang on, don't just shout all out. Just please lift your hands. You wanted to say something? No, you? Yes? Sophistication, okay. What else? Yes? Huh? What? Comfortable. Well, comfortable, you know, mode of ignorance can also be very comfortable, yeah. No, but what's goodness? Yeah, simple, clean, body nicely covered, you know, for the women it's long skirts, you know, like, do you have Laura Ashley? Anybody heard of Laura Ashley fashion? Yeah, you have heard of Laura Ashley. Yeah, they have it in all big cities, Sydney, Paris, London. You know, Laura Ashley is this fashion from 100 years ago or something with long skirts and the blouses all buttoned up and little frilly things here and there and all little floral design, and it looks really neat and nice and very expensive, and they have interior designs too, the curtains and bed covers and all, like 100 years ago with little frilly things and so on, you know. And the body is simply nicely covered, you know. Like in India, fashion and the mode of goodness would be the Punjabi suits, you know. That's goodness, you know, simply the body nicely covered in a simple way, you know. And for the men, also nicely covered, simple way. Nothing calling for attention here or something, but just plain and simple and clean, you know. Okay, so now let's have a look in spiritual culture. What's the transcendental fashion? Sari, yes. Or for the men, dhoti, yes, yes, definitely. Sari, most elegant way to cover the body and to remind everybody of Krishna. Even when I flew yesterday, the stewardess asked me, you know, because I don't have any other clothes except this. I'm always traveling like this, especially since I have a shaved head. You know, it looks weird if you wear anything else except a sari and a shaved head. So I only travel with sari, and so many preaching opportunities come up, and the stewardess asked me, oh, which faith are you, and this and that. So I gave her a little brochure about Krishna consciousness and so on. Yeah. Yeah, so it immediately reminds people of God. You see? And interestingly, of course, sari dhoti is not the only transcendental fashion. We have to be a little broad-minded. So even a nun's outfit, I would also put that under transcendental fashion because it definitely reminds people of God. And if you look a little deeper, you can see there's the same principles there. The head is covered and the nuns have this back thing there covering the back too, you know, like the headpiece of the sari. It's all there, you know, and the whole body nicely covered, reducing the fever of lust. It's all there. You see? Or the Muslims, burqas, this, that. You will find the same principles in every spiritual culture. Because ultimately, every religion comes from the root of Sanatana Dharma. Because we know, you know, the previous ages, the whole world was one kingdom. Prithu Maharaj, Yudhishthira Maharaj, they were ruling the world. So the world religion was Sanatana Dharma, was Krishna consciousness. And then as the whole, you know, kingdom was breaking up in so many countries and kingdoms, that's how the religions developed differently. You see? So therefore, the root of all religions is definitely Sanatana Dharma. You see? And therefore, also in all religious, you know, in all spiritual cultures, you will find the same principles there. Yes, sir. Even for the men, no spiritual path where the men are, you know, seriously practicing, the men wear pants and shirt. They don't. They always wear some kind of robes, right? The Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, you name it. The serious ones, they don't wear pants and shirt. They always have robes. You see? So, and this is also part of spiritual fashion. You see? And that kind of dressing, that kind of spiritual fashion, it reduces bodily concept. That's what it is meant for. It is reducing this identification of I am this body. For the last 7 or 8 years, that's how long I've been shaving, I really noticed this. I have not worn a single day anything else except a sari, and it makes a big difference on your consciousness. Yes. Yes. And for those who are a little perceptive, you can feel, you know, as soon as you step into a pair of pants or jeans, you immediately, the mind starts thinking, oh, what am I look like? Is this, you know, is this fashionable? Oh, I put on weight. I have to lose weight. Immediately, this whole bodily concept, you know, starts going through the mind. You see? So that's what the spiritual fashion is doing. It is simply reducing this whole bodily identification. It is reducing the fever of lust. It is reducing this whole thing of, oh, I want to be so special and noticed and, you know. Yeah. Yeah, that's the whole purpose of it. Yeah. Let's have a look at hairstyle. Hairstyle in materialistic culture, mode of ignorance. What does hairstyle and mode of ignorance look like? Dreadlocks, yes. Yes, we'll exclude the sadhus. But simply dirty, matted, you know, uncombed dreadlocks. What else? Dirty, we said already. What else? Huh? Yes, the whole punk thing, you know, all spikes and crazy colors, pink, purple, green, you know, all crazy shave patterns in the head and, oh, you know, so many things. So this is mode of ignorance, you know. You have punks here in Ljubljana? Yes, some of them. Okay, so that's mode of ignorance. So what's hairstyle in the mode of passion? Fancy. Well, first of all, open hair for the women. Open hair. Because hair, very attractive, very sensual. People spend so much time and money at the hairdresser, you know? Hair, very attractive. So showing off your beautiful curly hair there, all open, this, that, or fancy cuts, all kinds of different arrangements there, whatever, you know? Yes, yes, that's mode of passion. Showing off, you know? Attracting the opposite gender. The man too, I mean, God, in Germany, it's also becoming for the men now a whole thing with the hairstyles, you know. They're putting all creams in and styling it with curls and, you know, standing up and this and that. I mean, my God, you know. Yeah, it's all, you know. Yeah, yeah, and people spend so much money, you know. This whole hairstyle is a whole fashion thing too. That, you know, people run to the hairdresser every couple of months and getting the latest cut and paying 100 euros there and this and that. Oh, it's a whole thing, you know. Yeah. So then the hairstyle in the mode of goodness, what's that? For the women? Yes, put the hair together, either in the knot or braid it or, you know, how do you call them on the side there? These ponytail things, you know, whatever, you know. Yeah, that's mode of goodness. You know, for the man, just simple, simple, neat, short. Yeah, yeah, that's mode of goodness. So now, transcendental. What's transcendental hairstyle for the women? What's transcendental? Huh? Covered, yes, yes. That's the transcendental hairstyle. And you will, huh? You're laughing. Huh? Okay. Yeah, I mean, I hope nobody gets offended here or something. You know, let's simply understand, and we can assess ourselves. We can see, or oh, where am I here on the spectrum? You know, how much have I moved already towards the day of the spiritualist? How much am I still on the side of the day of the materialist? How much am I still hanging on to those tastes and likes and dislikes? Or how much have I already transformed? You know. Good to assess. And as I said, it's a gradual thing which we have to take individually or by ourselves. You know, we have to do that internal work. So it's not that we are pushing here or something, or every woman has to have their head covered. No, no, no. But let's see, you know, what is the day of the materialist? What's the day of the spiritualist? And how do we get there? Right? Like that. Yes. Interestingly, you will find that this thing of covering the head, you will find in every spiritual culture. I mean, Ukraine, I spend a lot of time in Ukraine, even now where it's politically a little topsy-turvy there. But when you go in a Russian Orthodox church, you cannot enter if you have not your head covered. They're so much more strict than we are. Even if it is symbolically, just a handkerchief on their head is enough and all right, you can go in, you know. But if a woman has not covered her head, she's not allowed to enter the church. Yes. Yes. So you will find this in all spiritual cultures. There's a deeper meaning to it, which we don't have time to get into this now. In Zagreb, yes, we will do a whole course, Women in Spiritual Culture in Zagreb. So if anybody of you feels inspired to come there, I would be very happy to see you there. There we are churning so many deep and interesting topics, getting insights into Krishna's system. That's the whole thing, you say. Krishna has given us a system in order to create harmony and stability in this world, and in order to support this transformation of the heart and consciousness. He has given us a complete and perfect system. And every time we think our system is better than Krishna's system, then, you know, we get misery, neglect, chaos, suffering. And this is what's going on in the modern days of Kali Yuga, you know. Whole society is upside down there, you know, because Krishna's system has gotten lost and forgotten, you know. So, and we've got access to Krishna's system. We have to show the world how human life is meant to be lived, you know, because actually people out there are fried, how we say, you know. They've had it. They're frustrated. They realize, God, this life is misery, you know. But they don't know the positive alternative. But we have access to Krishna's system. But first we have to understand it ourselves and practice it. And then we can show the world how human life is meant to be lived. In peace and harmony and stability. Yes, sir. That's what Krishna's system is all about, to bring that into human society. So that we can wholeheartedly develop our relationship with Krishna. We need stability and harmony. And that's what culture is meant to do, you know, to give that stability and harmony, you know. Yes. Yes. Just by the way, my mother told me this quite a few years ago. She read that some English sociologist, he tried to determine which nation is the most happy nation. And he came to the conclusion that the Bangladeshis are the most happy nation. So, I mean, there must be something we can learn from them, you know. And it's true, you know. Yes. There's only 1% divorce rate in Bangladesh. It's almost non-existing. And 75% of Bangladeshi population lives in villages. And that is happy life, village life, you know. Yes. Anyway. Where were we? Hairstyle and the mode of transcendental. Huh? Oh, for the women it's covered. For the man, what's transcendental hairstyle for the man? Shaved, yes. You will find this also in every spiritual culture, you know? That all those men who take it really seriously, they're shaved or buzzed up at least, you know? Very short, you know? Yeah. Yeah. And again, that gets you off the bodily platform, you know? Some men have told me how it was for them a big step to shave up the first time, you know? And you're worried, oh, what will I look like? My ears will stand off more and my big nose is more visible and, you know, yeah, it's for the men also sometimes a bit of a thing, you know? And that helps to get off the bodily platform. You know, it does. It does. That's what it's meant to be about, you know. Yes. Okay, so let's quickly go through the example of music. Music in materialistic culture. Music in the mode of ignorance. What's that? Huh? Somebody said Mozart? Did I hear properly? No. Music in the mode of ignorance. Heavy metal. Huh? Too loud, yeah. Actually, I like to give the example of techno music, you know? Just noise and rhythm. There's no melody, no words, nothing. It's just, you know, and rhythm, you know? That's really heavy ignorance, you know? You can't even call it music anymore, you know? Yes, that's really mode of ignorance. So then, mode of passion. Music in the mode of passion, what's that? Jazz, rock, pop. Yes, I love you, you love me. I cannot live without you. Or this kind of thing, you know. Or in India, it's the cinema music, you know. Or the Bollywood thing, you know. Yes. Yeah, and I mean that's why the whole world loves rock music, pop music, because it actually propagates sex life. Let's be clear on this. It does. Even just the whole rhythm and the instruments and, you know, that's why everybody loves it. You know? Good. So now often the question comes, what about, you know, Hare Krishna rock music? Well, I always compared with the methadone treatment that the heroin addicts take, you know. If you're addicted to heroin, you take a drug called methadone, which is a drug, and that is meant to gradually wind you off the heroin, you know. So that's kind of what the rock music with the Maha Mantras, you know. And I'm speaking of own experience. I mean, I was heavily addicted to rock music when I was a young woman, you know. I used to visit all these rock concerts in Germany and all that. So when I became a devotee, I was 26 at the time, you know, so I had already a good doses of material life. So, you know, the transcendental music was too sattvic for me, you know. I didn't have the taste. I needed the rock music. And for the first few years, all I was listening to was the Hare Krishna rock music, you know. Yes, yes. So, but now, my God, I can't stand it anymore, you know. I really can't stand it. So we are meant to transform our taste. Yes, because even Krishna conscious rock music, still the sound vibration of the whole rock and roll is there. You know? Yes, yes. And that reminds us of the old taste. That's why we like it. And it does, in a subtle way, still carry that vibration of passion and sex life and all that, you know? But for those who are heavily addicted to rock music, all right, better they listen to rock music with the Maha Mantra, and then if they seriously chant and attend, you know, Bhagavatam regularly, then hopefully, and engage in some devotional service, then hopefully, after some time, their taste and likes and dislikes will transform, hopefully. Right? So that's my understanding of rock music and Krishna consciousness. Yeah. Yes. So, and music in the mode of goodness. What's that? Classic. Yeah, every country has its classical music. You know, in India it's the pan flute and the tabla and sitar and this and that. And in Europe it's Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, and, you know. So that's mode of goodness. Promoting the mode of goodness, definitely. Even plants like it better. It's a proven fact. Plants grow better with classical music than with techno. They don't like techno. Yes, right? Yes. No, it's a fact. Yeah. So now, transcendental music. What's that? Bhajan, kirtan. That's the topmost transcendental music, but it's not the only one. Even the European church music, the Handel, Bach, the Weihnachtsoratorium there, the Christmas oratorium, all these things. I grew up with all this classical music. I used to sing in a church choir. I mean, it's definitely a spiritual experience to sing in a beautiful, big old church. You know, these classical church music, it's all words from the Bible, all glorifying the Lord. Come on, you know. But it will not bring us to the level of Raja Bhakti. That only the Maha Mantra is taking us. You know, that's the point. Not topmost. But it is a spiritual experience. It is glorifying the Lord. Any music where the Lord is glorified, we have to be fair. Come on. That is part of spiritual music, definitely. Or, you know, being in a Muslim country, Bangladesh, you know, there's the whole namaz going through, whole Dhaka there, you know, six times a day, the Muslim prayers. And I actually quite like it, to be honest. It's, you know, sometimes they chant these Muslim prayers very nicely. It almost sounds like our Sanskrit Bhagavatam verses, you know. Yes, yes. And it reminds of God. Yes, eh? Yes. Yeah, so, but of course, Kirtan, holy name, that's the topmost transcendental music, right? Yeah, so, you know, these examples, you basically can play the same system through with anything. Recreation, education, this, that. You can do in materialistic culture, goodness, passion, ignorance, spiritual culture, transcendental. You know, and you can play through like this any part of our daily life, actually. You know, and see, how is it in spiritual culture? How is it in materialistic culture? You know? So now, understanding all this, we will finish soon. I know you've been sitting here for a while now. So, it's playing through the examples and understanding the different worldviews that both cultures are propagating, it becomes very clear. If we want to seriously progress in spiritual life, very helpful if we surround ourselves by as many aspects of spiritual culture as possible, because that propagates the certain worldview and consciousness which we are trying to develop, right? That gets us off the whole bodily concept, helps us to reduce the fever of lust, helps us to reduce the false ego, not wanting to be special and unique and extraordinary and recognized, and. So, you know, the more we imbibe all these aspects of spiritual culture in our daily life, the more helpful it will be. You see? And ultimately, as we said, you know, the day of the materialist has to become our night. You know? Sooner or later. Will not happen from one day to another. Definitely not. But we have to keep that goal in mind and work towards it and try and transform. You see? So we go to 3, are we? Or how long are we going? Yes. Maybe very, very briefly, because I gave you 2 pages. Now we are at the end of the first page. Obviously, we don't have that much time for the second page left. But I just want to very briefly touch on this, that the culture does not only affect different aspects of our life, but also relationships. It was mentioned, and it is a very strong difference there. Let us look at 3 sections of society. How they are viewed in materialistic culture, how they are viewed in spiritual culture. Very, very different. And if we look a little deeper, we can see that very often we are carrying this materialistic conditioning and we are bringing that into ISKCON and we are still stuck there. You see? So let us look, for example, at the position of elderly people in society. How are they looked at in materialistic culture? Old people. Yeah, it's a burden, you know? Because in a culture where sense gratification is the goal, anybody who is over 50 here might not be so many, but anybody who is knows the old body is not so suitable for sense gratification anymore. You can't keep up in the race for sense gratification. So therefore, old people, you know, you lost the race. You pushed aside, you know, you burden, unwanted, off to the nursing home, hidden in the forest. Nursing homes are a manifestation of materialistic culture. In spiritual culture, they don't exist. Yes, let's be clear on this. Yes. Yeah. So old people, materialistic culture, pushed aside, no respect, no value, can't enjoy, burden, off in the nursing home. In short terms. So now in spiritual culture, how do we look at elderly people there? Respect. What else? What do they embody? Realization, wisdom, life experience, spiritual advancement. Right? Yes. They're very, very important members of society. They are meant to teach the young generation, you know, and share their life experience. And they're offered humble service and respect, and people inquire from them. Yes, sir. They are the ones who pass down the traditions. Yes, sir. Yes. Yeah, that's another important thing, which we don't have any time now for that. Whole topic of women's protection. Yeah, so anyway, that's their position in spiritual culture. Most valuable members of society. Wisdom, love experience, self-realization they embody. Right? And they're taken care of with affection, you know, and respect. Nobody in spiritual culture would put their elderly people into some nursing home. Doesn't exist. My God. You know? Yes. So now children. What's the position of children in materialistic culture? Also burden. Yeah. That's why people put their children, you know, in the daycare center from 6 weeks onwards. My God. You know? They're a burden. Yes, pushed aside, neglected, unwanted. Yes. Maybe there's a little bit of sense gratification there to have some little expansion who looks like you and so on, you know, and trying to be a little Krishna there with expansions. But, you know, and buying all the fashion for the kids so they look like me and this and that. But ultimately, you know, it's kids are a little toy. There are toys for the grown-ups, but only to some extent. And then off to the daycare center, you know. So, and in spiritual culture, what is the position there of children? Yes, they're the future. They're the most important members, you know. Oh, they're in the center of life are the children. I've really experienced that in Bangladesh, yeah. Yeah, so they're given, you know, there the understanding is there that you have to plant the seed of devotional life right at the very beginning of a child's life, even before conception, in the womb. It's a whole thing, a whole big science, how to invite a highly elevated soul to take birth in your family, Gabadan Samskar, whole big science, you know, but this is all lost and forgotten. I mean, the demigods are queuing up to take birth in Lord Chaitanya Sankirtan movement. So how long do they have to queue up, you know? They don't want to take birth in just any family, you know? So, I mean, God, if our young devotees learn all these things, whoo, you know, then Lord Chaitanya Sankirtan movement can become very powerful, you know? If you invite some sadhu there to take birth in your family. Amazing, you know? Yeah. Yeah, so children, you know, are the center of life in spiritual culture. They really are. You know. So now mothers. Mothers in materialistic culture, what's their position? Not only servant, but I would say slave. And you said? Not respected at all. They're not valued. What? Your only mother and housewife? Is that all you're doing? You know? Yes. The poor thing. She can't enjoy life. She can't develop all of her amazing talents and get this degree and that degree and earn a lot of money. Oh, she just has to be at home and serve. What a pitiful condition. She's just the doormat. You know? Everybody wipes their feet on her type thing, you know? Not valued whatsoever. This whole position of mother is completely lost in materialistic culture. Completely. You know, because being a mother, you can't enjoy it. You know, you have to serve. Yes. And nobody wants to serve in materialistic culture, you know. So being a mother doesn't count at all. Nothing. So, and spiritual culture, what's the position of mothers? First guru, yes. I mean, she's not only first guru. She is the one who creates the whole spiritual atmosphere in the homes. It's the mother. Yes. That's her purifying duty. Yes. And in the family means in society, because society is built of many families. So it's the mother. She creates that whole spiritual atmosphere in the homes. She sows the seed of bhakti in the child's heart. There's a verse in Manu Samhita, mother is 1,000 times more important than a father. Sorry, but that's what Manu Samhita says. Yeah, I mean, the mothers are the topmost personalities in human society. They're the backbone of humanity, actually. Yes. This year in Mayapur, we had a program celebrating the glories of our mothers. It was very nice. Shivam Swami spoke very nicely, Chandramouli Swami. There's an article on Dandavats at the moment, if you want to look up. Yeah, we have to reestablish the important position of mothers. Yes, it's all lost and forgotten. It's a whole big topic. We'll talk about it in Zagreb. If you want to know more, come to Zagreb. Bit of advertisement here. Yeah, so, you know, there you can see already these three sections of society, completely different position. You know, elderly people, children, mothers. Materialistic culture, we can say, it is a culture of abandoning each other. Right? Husband abandons wife. Wife abandons husband. Parents abandon children. Children abandon the parents and grandparents. Everybody's abandoning each other for the sake of sense gratification. Right? Yes. Materialistic culture is a culture of neglect and abandoning each other. Spiritual culture is a culture of care. It promotes care. It's actually Krishna's system for devotee care, that spiritual culture. You might know we have a GBC committee for devotee care in ISKCON. For some years I was active in that. But then I realized actually spiritual culture is Krishna's system for devotee care. No need to reinvent the wheel. You know, Krishna gave it all. So let's just become more conscious of spiritual culture and try and put it in our lives as much as we can. And then all the sections within society will be perfectly taken care of by everybody performing their purifying duties towards each other. You see? But all that is all lost and forgotten in materialistic life. You know? Anyway, let us see if there's any more questions. Yes? Well, let us hear one of your questions and then we'll ask the others. One question you can say. Maybe we don't have time for all of them.
Thank you very much.
See, I mean, this topic of spiritual culture is a big topic. As I was saying, I've got all these courses, you know, I think we have to start with systematic education. We have to educate. Like Prabhupada used to say, before we can become Krishna conscious, we have to become conscious. So let's start to become conscious here, you know? Just becoming conscious what these cultures are all about, how they develop, what is the underlying philosophy, the worldview, and we first have to understand, you know? We have to understand. It's not good enough just to say, oh, why don't you have a dhoti? Why don't you have a sari? No, we have to understand. Why? What is it doing to my consciousness? You know? Yes, yes. So we have to educate and train devotees. You know? And then, as I said, it's a gradual thing. We have to gradually endeavor to put things in our life. And I mean, this is why Prabhupada actually wanted devotees to spend time in India, you know, to learn the culture. But today already in India, I'm giving these courses for the women and spiritual culture. I did a whole tour around India, South India, Coimbatore, Bangalore. It's revolutionary even there. Yes, because all the women in India, they all look towards the West. They all want to become independent career women. They all wear kami clothes. You know, it's a whole thing, you know. Yes. And of course, if these things come from a German woman's mouth, it is pretty effective, you know. Yes, as if I had an Indian body or a Russian body or something, then people would say, yeah, well, she's Indian, she's Russian, okay. But German, wow, you know. Then it has a different effect, you know. Yeah. So education is number one. We have to hear about it. We have to become conscious. You know, we have to understand that Krishna consciousness is not an external thing of just, you know, walking around with a bead bag or something, but inside we are maintaining all the materialistic ways of life and the ties and attachments. You know, I mean, that's the tenth offense, to chant the holy name. And with material attachment, even after understanding so many instructions on these matters. So while we hang on to all these materialistic tastes, you know, our spiritual life has not become very deep. So we have to deepen it. That's what Prabhupada said with boiling the milk. Right? There's famous letters where Prabhupada says, now, you know, where he expresses his concern not to spread more and more widely, you know, but rather boil the milk. Like when we make burfi, the milk becomes sweet and solid. So we have to become burfi-like devotees, sweet and solid, you know, and deepen our spiritual life, get deeper understandings. You see? So it will take time. It's a big topic. Cannot be done from 1 minute to the other. Cannot be fully understood and discussed in 2 hours, you know. But let's understand the differences, you know. What else? Okay.
Thank you for the lecture, but I would like to know what's your opinion in regards to what you said about the Vidyananda Swami Krishna West project.
To be honest, I don't really know so much of what exactly he says, you know. But one thing is, we have to discriminate between our personal spiritual practice, our personal likes and dislikes, and how we preach. Like, for example, when I was flying yesterday, you know, sometimes when I travel in Germany, I don't wear tilak. Simply not to confront people unnecessarily with too much, you know, day and night here, you see. I think sari and shaved head is already enough. You know, no need to, you know, confront people too much. So this is one thing. Because these two cultures are like day and night, that's when we go out and preach. Let's say you meet the, you know, the mayor of Ljubljana or something. All right, maybe then it might be better if you come in a suit and tie or something. Might be. Maybe not, doesn't have to be, but can be. Simply not to build these cultural barriers because these two cultures are like day and night. And if a person is completely rooted in the day of the materialist, then the day of the spiritualist will be ignorance for him. It will be madness. It will be illusion. So that's why sometimes for the sake of preaching, that's why some book distributors prefer to go out in pants, not to confront people. So we don't want to start now a discussion about that. Some people do like this. Some people do like that. Okay, whatever works for you, you know. All right. But that is one thing, you know, how we preach sometimes. But another thing is, what do we like best? And it's very clear, you know, as long as we feel more comfortable in pants, well, then obviously we are still identifying more with being a non-devotee. Very clear. Because, you know, when we have transformed our taste and we feel more comfortable in the dhoti and we feel more comfortable in the sari, well, then the transformation has been done more already towards the day of the materialist. It's very clear. And I remember myself. It took me so many years. For so many years, I felt more comfortable in jeans. Yes. The material conditioning we are carrying with us, the material tastes, the material likes. Took me a long time. Almost 30 years. Now, let's say 22 years or something, you know, or 20 years. Yeah, but it takes time. It takes time, you know. And I see it in Ukraine all the time, you know. People come, the ladies come in kami clothes to the program. Then in the changing room, they put a sari on for the program. Then as soon as the program is finished, they go in the changing room, put on their clothes, you know, their pants on again. And I'm always thinking, my God, you know, the KGB days are over, you know. So what's the problem? Why not walk down the street in a sari? It looks so nice, so attractive. People like it. But obviously, they still identify more with being a non-devotee. Yes, sir. It's a deep internal thing. Yes, sir. Even in material terms, a uniform strengthens your identity. That's why a policeman wears a policeman uniform. So he knows, I'm a policeman. I have to do the job of a policeman now. Or doctor, or whatever. That's why we have uniforms. You know? So naturally, the uniform of a devotee, that strengthens immensely the identity of being a devotee. Yes, immensely. And you have to be ready to represent Prabhupada at any minute. You can't do any nonsense because people see you, oh, he's a Hare Krishna. People come up to you all the time and will ask you questions. Happens to me all the time. I had the most amazing preaching opportunities, you know, that I met some Prabhupada disciples who were disconnected with ISKCON for 20 years, and because I walked around like that, they recognized me, they came up to me, oh, Hari Bol, you know, like this. Yeah, yeah, I had the most amazing experiences walking around in devotional clothes. And you have to be ready to be exemplary at any time and preach. You represent Prabhupada. So it has a big influence on your consciousness. Definitely. But for the sake of preaching, maybe there are situations where we don't want to confront people with the day of the spiritualist, you know, and that's why we can sometimes also, even Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur gave that example. He walked around in suits and, you know, but definitely, I mean, Prabhupada, you know, never wore anything else. I don't think there's a picture of Prabhupada in jeans or something. And, well, if we want to go to Goloka Vrindavan one day, well, we better develop the taste, you know, to be there. Our people walk around like that, there, you know. So if we don't have the taste, what are we going to do there? You know, nobody walks around in jeans there. So why not prepare already now, you know, to develop that taste? Because it's Krishna's culture. You know? It's 3:07. I don't know how long we should go. Huh? Yeah, I think so too. Anyway, thank you so much for your interest in this topic. And to be continued some other time. Okay, thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveda Bhaktivinoda ki, Gaura Premanandi, Hare Hare Bol, Hare Krishna.